From North Dakota to Florida, Washington to Alabama, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, President Donald Trump's efforts to remove illegal aliens from the country have run into left-wing attacks over so-called due process. To explain what due process is, we talk with Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation. There will be a number of key gubernatorial races in states across the nation in 2026. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. President Trump is using tariffs both as a bargaining tool and a revenue generator. But what will the courts ultimately decide? Eric Boehm and Damon Root of Reason Magazine explore. And fans of baseball traditions are not liking new rules designed to speed up the game. We learn more from Dr. Paul Kengor of the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. President Donald Trump's administration is moving aggressively to deport millions of illegal aliens, especially those who have committed a crime. But those efforts have encountered pushback over so-called due process. For a look at the controversy, we turn to Hans von Spakovsky. He is Senior Legal Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Hans, welcome back to American Radio Journal.
Hans, we continue to hear a lot of protesting from the left about illegal immigrants who are being removed from the United States, and they're claiming they're not getting due process. That's a bit of a nebulous term. What do we mean by due process, particularly in this instance?
Well, folks generally refer with due process to the ability to appear before a judge and make clear your case. But what's happening here is that these critics are confusing a criminal case with a civil case. And what I mean by that is, look, if you're being criminally prosecuted, you know, you're being prosecuted by the government for, you know, assault, rape, burglary, kidnapping. You are entitled to constitutional due process, you know, the right to have a lawyer represent you, the right to take the Fifth Amendment, constitutional due process. And that applies whether you are a citizen or an alien here legally or illegally. But immigration proceedings that are intended to either bar an alien from coming into the country or to remove an alien, that is not a criminal proceeding. And so you are not entitled to constitutional due process rights. You know, everybody knows about Miranda, right? You know, we've seen this on a million TV shows, right? When you're arrested, the cops have to read you your Miranda rights, right? Telling you you have a right to remain silent, you have a right to an attorney. Immigration officers, when they catch an alien, they don't have to read them their Miranda rights because immigration proceedings are civil proceedings. And the only due process that aliens are entitled to is what Congress has given them through the immigration statute. And in particular, in many of these cases that we're now seeing in the news, they've already had them. They've already had their appearance before a immigration judge. The judge reviewed their case, said, no, you're not entitled to be in the U.S., and has issued a deportation order. Once that deportation order is issued, government can pick you up, take you straight to the airport, put you on a plane, and ship you out of the country. And all these federal judges who are getting in and telling the government, oh, you can't do that, when a deportation order has already been issued, they are acting beyond the law and unlawfully.
If a deportation order has not been issued then, Hans, is there any sort of due process required at that point?
If you look at the immigration statutes, what they say is, well, your due process rights are what the government gives you, what Congress has given you. So I think at the most that is required on the immigration laws is for you, the illegal alien, to be able to at least present your defense. And it doesn't have to be in a court. You just have to be able to speak to a employee in the federal executive branch to say, well, no, actually, I'm really here legally. Here's my proof. But this idea that you have to have a full-blown hearing or trial In a federal court, no, you are not entitled to that as an alien. And in particular, like I said, if the deportation order has already been issued, you can be picked up and immediately shipped out of the country.
President Trump, of course, here, Hans, is taking a lot of heat over this, despite the fact that illegal immigration was either one or two in the polls all year last year during the presidential election. Yep. And it was obvious that it was a priority of many people that he do exactly what it is he's doing. But if you even go back in time, back specifically to the Clinton administration, there have been some laws and some rulemaking that streamlined this process, has there not?
Yeah, there has. And in fact, remember that we one of the first things that this president actually got passed also was the Laken Riley Act. And that also, in addition to the expedited removal process that had previously passed Congress, particularly for aliens who've committed crimes, the Laken Riley Act even sped that up. Boy, you commit a serious crime under that new law, and in essence, the government can pick you up and, again, ship you right out of the country. And judges who are preventing that, and judges who are preventing members of terrorist groups from being removed from the country, they are acting outside of their authority under the law.
So these judges that are acting outside their authority, and not only in when it comes to immigration and due process, but in many and various areas, they are attempting to block the president's efforts and his agenda that we, the voters, put him into office to enact. What can be done about these sort of rogue justices that are throwing a monkey wrench into the situation? Is there anything that can be done to them?
The Supreme Court is the highest court in the land, and they are the ones that have got to step in and do something about this. You know, just a week or so ago, there was a case argued before the U.S. Supreme Court on an emergency appeal involving the issue of birthright citizenship. Now, that case wasn't before the Supreme Court on the substantive merits of whether or not, you know, Donald Trump is correct on his interpretation of that issue. It was before the court on the issue of nationwide injunctions that had been issued by federal judges in three different states. That case is an opportunity for the Supreme Court, I hope, to come out saying nationwide injunctions are improper. They can only be issued under very limited circumstances. And they need to come out, with, like I said, with a very tough decision that lays down hard rules that go after all of these judges issuing these nationwide injunctions in so many different areas. The other thing that needs to happen is Congress needs to pass legislation. The House already has done so. The House recently passed a bill that basically says, in order to avoid judge shopping, because that's what's been going on, liberals pick ideologically left judges in particular states that they know will rule their way, no matter what the law or the Constitution says. The House passed a bill saying that any kind of action against, for example, a presidential executive order has to be heard by a three-judge panel. Three judges, not one judge who's shopped for by the left. And any appeal would go straight to the U.S. Supreme Court, bypassing the courts of appeals, therefore speeding up the process and requiring the Supreme Court to step in and look at the case. That's something the Senate needs to pass. That needs to be made law. So that would be a legislative partial solution to this.
We have been talking with Hans von Spakovsky, who is a senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation, about due process, particularly as it relates to the deportation of illegal immigrants. Hans, if we have listeners who would like to learn more, tell us a little bit about Heritage and where can they find you on the web to learn more?
Well, Heritage is the largest conservative, and by that I mean folks who believe in the Constitution and the rule of law, think tank in the world. They can go to heritage.org, heritage.org, and find not only what I write, but what all of our other nationally recognized experts write on domestic and foreign policy issues.
Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation. Hans, thank you for being back with us.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. We usually talk about U.S. Senate, U.S. House of Representatives, a lot of national issues. But coming up in 2026, we have a number of states that will be holding races for governor, a number of them very critical to the future of the country. And we're going to talk about some of those key gubernatorial races with Scott Parkinson. Scott, good to have you here.
Thank you, Loman.
Why don't we just, we'll move from west to east here, Scott. Let's start out in Arizona. Arizona has become a real battleground state in recent cycles, so we have a gubernatorial race looming there for next year. What's happening in Arizona?
Well, your listeners might remember that in 2022, Carrie Lake was defeated in Arizona for the governor's race against another woman named Katie Hobbs. So that race is back up, and front and center is Karen Taylor Robson against Andy Biggs. Earlier in December, she got the endorsement from President Trump. He was in Arizona, noticed her in the crowd, and said that she would have his support if she declared for the governor's race. And she actually ran against Carrie Lake in 2022. Fast forward a month and a half later, and Congressman Andy Biggs says, hey, you know, I'm actually thinking about running for governor too. And I've actually supported and defended Donald Trump all along the way in his entire political career. They're also a strong ally of each other. And so as the polling has sort of progressed over the last several months, Club for Growth issued a poll and it found that Andy Biggs is going to win this primary, especially if he had President Trump's endorsement as well. And President Trump ultimately decided to issue a dual endorsement of both Taylor Robson and also of Andy Biggs. And so this has been, I think, one of those primaries that's going to be a slugfest. It's in August of 2026. Whether the people of Arizona are going to vote for Andy Biggs or Karen Robson Taylor, we know that this is going to be a seat that's competitive for the general election against Katie Hobbs. We think that Andy Biggs gives us the best opportunity to elect a conservative governor, and obviously that's going to be a big, big race. We think Biggs is the guy, so I'm excited about that one. And so the next state that I want to highlight is Kansas. And in Kansas, there's going to be another competitive Republican primary in August of 2026. And right now, there are four competitive candidates that are running in that race. The first one is a former governor named Jeff Collier. Collier was governor for a short time and ran in 2018 against Kris Kobach. And Kobach won that nomination, but ultimately lost the general election. And Democrats have been running in Kansas and winning. And it sounds kind of weird because, first of all, you know, Kansas is a bright red state, and it's a state that Trump easily wins. But for some reason, in these state gubernatorial races, Democrats are competitive. You remember Kathleen Sebelius was a governor of Kansas and later served as HHS secretary for Barack Obama. Well, we've got a similar situation now, but Jeff Collier is a strong candidate. You've also got another candidate named Ty Masterson. You've got Vicky Schmidt, who's a statewide office holder as a superintendent. And then Scott Schwab, I believe, is the last candidate. You know, this is going to be one of those races that I think paves the future for Kansas. And is it going to be a conservative future? Is it going to be sort of the establishment? Or is it going to be a candidate that can lose to a Democrat again? And that's one I think that is definitely worth watching very, very closely. Obviously, down in the Sunshine State of Florida, Byron Donalds is a congressman from Naples, the 19th Congressional District of Florida. He announced many, many months ago that he was running for governor after, you know, it'd been rumored for a long time. And he received President Trump's complete and total endorsement. The issue here in this race, and it's another one in August of 2026, I'm giving you a little bit of a theme. The issue there is that Ron DeSantis is term limited, and his wife, Casey DeSantis, the First Lady of Florida, has been really testing the waters and considering whether she's going to run for governor in 2026 against Byron Donalds in the primary. The DeSantis family and their brand all throughout Florida has a really, really strong favorability from the people of Florida. And obviously, he was a contender for president against Donald Trump in the Republican primary of 2024. But you know, we'll see in the coming weeks and months whether this is a race that the First Lady of Florida decides to get in. One of the interesting things about Florida Loman is that the filing deadline for that race isn't until June of 2026. So we might be waiting for a while to learn whether Byron Donalds has a competitive primary for that August primary date.
And if we go deep in the heart of Dixie, I'm talking about Alabama, very interesting situation developing there. Can you quickly give us the rundown?
Yeah. So this last week, Tommy Tuberville, the United States Senator from Alabama and former head football coach at Auburn University, he declared for the governor's race and has basically cleared the field. Club for Growth PAC has endorsed Coach Tuberville in this race. And the interesting thing about it is he has incredible popularity among the people of Alabama, and he's effectively cleared the field. Other people that were testing the waters spoke with Coach Tuberville and have decided that they're not going to run. But what it has done with him announcing for governor, it's creating an open United States Senate race in Alabama, and that's going to be quite interesting to see who gets in the race and how competitive they'll be. There's not going to be another situation like Doug Jones or any other Democrat being able to win statewide in Alabama in 2026.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a little bit about the Club for Growth.
Club for Growth is based out of Washington, D.C. We also have Club for Growth PAC that makes endorsements for candidates in the House, Senate, and governor's races all throughout America. Visit clubforgrowth.org, where you can actually sign up and become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, check in with you next week. Thank you.
You're welcome.
President Trump's aggressive use of tariffs will ultimately end up before the Supreme Court of the United States. What is their likely fate? Eric Boehm and Damon Root of Reason Magazine are here to discuss.
President Donald Trump's tariffs have had a rough week or so in court, and they could be headed eventually to the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll take a look back at what's been done so far and take a little bit of a look ahead at what the future could hold for these two legal cases challenging Donald Trump's tariffs on this episode of the program. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Damon Root. He's a senior editor at Reason Magazine, and he's also the author of a new newsletter for us, Injustice System, a newsletter about law, politics, and history. Damon has written several books on those topics. He's excellent. Subscribe to the newsletter. Check out his work at Reason, and we are glad to have him here on the program as well. Damon, thanks for taking some time out of your busy schedule to join us here today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
All right, so let's talk tariffs. Let's jump back, actually, a couple of weeks to what's gone on. There were two separate rulings, but very similar in a lot of ways. Two rulings that said Trump's tariffs have been unlawfully imposed, and then one of those rulings has now kind of been paused by a higher court. But take us briefly, if you can, through the arguments that these two courts made in those decisions that came down back to back last week.
Sure. So what the court said, and I think correctly, is that the president does not have the unilateral authority under the Constitution to launch a trade war, to impose tariffs. That is something that is in the hands of Congress in the Constitution. You know, you've got Article 1, which spells out the powers of one branch of government. You've got Article 2 that spells out another. And if you look where the powers to impose tariffs, to tax, to do all these sorts of regulatory things, that is in the part of the Constitution that gives powers to Congress, not to the president. So there is a separation of powers argument here that the president has usurped the lawmaking authority. And there's also a constitutional principle called the non-delegation doctrine, which says that one branch cannot hand its powers away to another branch. So even if Congress wants to delegate just kind of wholesale give the lawmaking authority to the president, actually the structure of the Constitution stands against that.
And as we go forward now with this, I mean, the crux of this issue is this law called the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, IEEPA. That's really at the heart of this. But I mean, what I hear Trump's people say, what I hear fans of the president and his tariffs say is like, okay, well, Congress, maybe the Constitution says Congress has this authority, but Congress has offloaded that authority over the years in a whole bunch of different laws. And the question before the courts is whether IEEPA specifically authorizes this sort of behavior, right?
That's right. And that law says, you know, when there's an emergency, the president can do certain things. But one thing the law doesn't say is tariffs. That, you know, that's not actually something that's spelled out in that law. It's being interpreted in a let's say an elastic sort of way to allow the president to do something he clearly wants to do. And again, this is what we saw with the Biden administration. If you remember the student debt cancellation plan, that was this post 9/11 law that was very limited, and it was about pausing student debts for basically service members, people who were involved in the war on terror. And the Biden administration did this very kind of elastic, stretchy reading of the law, and said, "Well, we can shoehorn in this entire unilateral student debt cancellation." The Supreme Court said, "No, you can't do that. There needs to be congressional authorizations for something like that. This is the president wielding powers that are actually properly in the hands of Congress." And so, you know, if you just remove the R or the D, you know, blank out the name of the president, you see the executive branch operating in the same way, I think, in both of these kind of situations. And I expect if the Supreme Court is serious about neutrally applying these principles that it has enforced in the past, that this is going to be a loser for Trump.
Yeah, I think that's a really great point. Look, if you didn't like Biden's student loan forgiveness and you thought that was unconstitutional, well, the legal principles would say the exact same thing about what Trump is trying to do now with tariffs. Different law, same principle underpinning both of them. We're talking with Damon Root. He's a senior editor at Reason Magazine. He's also the author of one of our new newsletters, Injustice System. You can go to reason.com and sign up for that. Check it out there. Damon, a couple of minutes left here. I want to finish on this, something you raised in your newsletter this week. And this is another point that we hear from the president's defenders all the time is like, hey, the president has the power here. Judges have to back off. They don't have the right to restrict the executive's behavior in this way. As you put it in your piece, doesn't the Supreme Court owe some deference to the president on this? Because, hey, you know, he's the one that was elected by the American people. He's the one who has these authorities and the court's got to back off. Can you respond to that?
I'd say there are two ways to think about that. The first is, and you've heard this from Stephen Miller, you've heard this from the president himself, you've heard this from various people in the Trump administration, which is that we were elected to do a job, the courts are getting in the way, they're thwarting the will of the people, that's anti-democratic. Well, the courts, the federal courts, are actually supposed to be an anti-democratic institution. I mean, that's the design of the judiciary, to act as a counter-majoritarian force. And for the simple reason that just because the American people elected a president to do something doesn't mean the president gets to do it. If what the president was elected to do is against the Constitution or is against the law. And so this idea that there should just be sort of across the board deference to the president because the president is popularly elected, that is something that cuts against everything in Article 3 of the Constitution. That's where the judicial power is spelled out for the federal courts and the power to review acts and strike down acts of the elected branches of government. So I would say that sort of knee-jerk judicial deference to the president, that's something, of course, that every president wants. And we've seen presidents like Franklin Roosevelt in the past, you know, tries to pack the Supreme Court because of that. Remember during the Biden years, there was all the Biden should pack the Supreme Court because the conservative justices were blocking Biden. You know, all of these, it's understandable chafing when the courts do their job, which is to act as a check. You know, James Madison said that the proper role of the courts was to act as an impenetrable bulwark against every assumption of power in the executive or legislative. So I just think that this idea of judicial deference to the courts just fundamentally misunderstands the constitutional structure and the relation between the branches and the checks and balances that are supposed to be there.
Yeah, you can change the letter, the R, the D. You can change the issue, the specifics of it. But the fact of executive power wanting to grow remains pretty much the same. Damon, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And once again, that's Damon Root, senior editor at Reason Magazine, senior editor at reason.com. And of course, sign up for his newsletter, Injustice System, newsletter about law, politics, and history. You can find that on our website at reason.com. I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Baseball is considered to be America's sport, but tinkering with the rules has riled fans of the sport's traditions. So says Dr. Paul Kengor, editor-in-chief of the American Spectator, on this American Radio Journal commentary.
While watching the dreadful Pittsburgh Pittsburgh Pirates recently. Yes, that's my home baseball team. I was struck by something very confusing. It was extra innings, and each team somehow started the inning with a runner on second base. The runner magically materialized on my TV after the commercial break. I tried to figure out when the player had batted, presumably with a leadoff double. I kept rewinding the recorder. I thought maybe the TV broadcast blew the coverage. But then the same thing happened the next inning. What was going on? Well, I soon learned that Major League Baseball and its slavish innovation to speed up the pace of the game, apparently at all costs, has created this new gimmick. It's called the artificial runner. I guess MLB and its fans don't like games that go into too many extra innings. And so they've thus concocted a plot to insert an artificial runner at the start of every extra inning. This ensures a greater likelihood of ending the game earlier. This also, of course, means goodbye to epic extra inning games. Personally, I thought those games were fascinating, like a chess match, as each team exhausted its roster. But apparently, MLB's hope is that such endurance tests never happen again. Of course, MLB recently implemented a clock for the pitcher, akin to the NBA's shot clock. That, too, was a major change, a bow at the altar of the all-important objective of speeding up the pace of the game. But why? Sure, baseball mavens will invoke all sorts of data and theories explaining why America's national pastime is no longer that, having ceded that title to the NFL. Their baseball fans, quote-unquote, are bored by long games. But the problem is, that's usually non-fans. The most devoted fans, often derided as purists or traditionalists like myself, we personally don't care whether our beloved sport averages 2 hours per game or 2.5 hours. Call us purists, but we don't care. We like long games, and we like watching them at the ballpark. What's great about baseball is that it never had a clock. Football and basketball and hockey have halves or quarters or periods, but with baseball, you play until one team outscores the other. As for fans bored by that, well, go watch the NFL and its vomitous, interminable litany of commercial breaks. Talk about long games! Watch an NFL game. This impatience of fans for the flow of America's national pastime, a game that goes back to the 19th century, is the fault not of the sport, but of modern Americans. We modern Americans want everything now. We can't wait. We detest inaction. Look at a group of people waiting for something, in a line. They're on their phones. They can't just sit or think or start a conversation with a stranger. The Italians have a saying. It's called dolce far niente. It means the sweetness of doing nothing. Put down your phone. Go for a walk. Sit at a park bench. Go to a creek. Watch. Observe. Talk to someone. Slow down. There can be a sweetness in doing nothing. Connecting this to baseball illustrates the point even more. You can go to a game in a nice setting. In fact, someone once observed that it's fitting that baseball is played in a park or a field rather than an arena or stadium. Stop. Go to a game. Take in the sounds, the sights, the feel at the ballpark. You can truly pass the time with baseball, almost literally every day from April to October. But you can't so sweetly pass the time when the game is artificially changed, sped up for people who don't appreciate the slower pace, whether at the ballpark or in their own hurried, impatient, busy lives. The problem isn't baseball, folks. It's us. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WZFC-FM in Winchester, Virginia, WEEM-FM in Pendleton, Indiana, along with KSAK-FM in Walnut, California. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.